So, ladies and gentlemen, this is obviously our next session, which is an interview with Jeremy Front. Jeremy is a writer for BBC Radio 4. He is also an actor. He trained as a painter initially at Goldsmiths and Central St. Martin's School of Arts, worked at various festivals, and he's written TV episodes of Monarch of the Glen and Holby City. His radio work includes the quite brilliant and intricate Charles Paris Mystery series, which has been aired not too long ago, relatively recently. He stars with his sister, Rebecca Front, in Millie and Jack, which aired quite recently, which, you know, is so funny and is well worth listening to if you wish to use catch-up. Today we're here to talk about Stamboul Train. The episode was 1.5 hours in length, which is quite unusual for BBC Radio 4. Their dramas are usually an hour. It was aired in November, the 18th of November 2017, and is quite dynamic. I must confess, I've listened to it now about 30 or 40 times.
Just far more than I have to confess.
And I think it really is a tour de force. Every time I hear something different, it feels a bit like a poem in terms of how well crafted and how intricate it is and how complex it is. I mean, it does a wonderful service to Green's novel. I'm conscious not all of you will have read Stamboul Train, therefore I would like to give you a short, very brief plot description. So the novel follows a train journey from Ostend through to Constantinople, obviously now Istanbul. There is a whole menagerie of characters on the journey, including Carlton Myatt, who is a trader of currants. He falls for a young dancer of variety named Coral Musker, who is pursued by a journalist named Mabel Warren, who is courting an escort named Janet Pardo. Mabel is also on a kind of journey insofar as she tracks down Richard Zinner on the train. Richard Zinner is a communist who is about to partake in an insurrection in Belgrade, which actually happens before he gets there, and so Mabel's story has been scooped. He is subject to a kangaroo court in Subotica when the authorities catch up with him, and the novel concludes with with Carlton Myatt actually getting together with Janet Pardo, who is the niece of another trader of currants named Stein. So it is.
Confused. Confused, you will be.
Slightly confused. Confused.com, yeah. A little. But it becomes clearer as you. I hope you will read the novel. The novel is for sale, by the way, at the back. And I hope you will go away and look up the radio broadcast. I don't think it's available now, but please listen out for Jeremy's work. It's all very, you know, intricately done. And I can't say enough what a great writer I think Jeremy is. So, Jeremy, welcome to Berkhamsted.
Thank you for inviting me. No, it's lovely to be here. And
perhaps we can start by saying, how did you come to be invited to adapt the novel for radio? What stages did you go through? How did that process work?
Well, there's always a long run-up. There's invariably a very long lead-up to these things. But I because I knew we were going to talk about this, I've tracked a few little... by the way, that's the script, in case anyone wants to know. I won't be reading it, but there it is with authentic coffee stains. But that's a 90-minute script. What happened was I got an email from Mark Beebe, who was the producer, and Mark and I had worked together. I dramatised Evelyn Waugh's Sword of Honour trilogy, and I did that as a 7-hour production. And that was interesting. It was one writer, and it started with one producer. And then suddenly they panicked and said, oh, I think we need another producer. So they brought in a second one, and then I was well into, I mean, it was a long project to work on, and then suddenly there was a third producer brought in as well. I thought, three to one. But that was Mark, and he did, I think, two episodes, and we got on very well. And I think the following year or so, he sent me this email, and it says here, it was the 18th of April, 2016. He was trying to get this away with the BBC, and would I be interested, if he could sell the project, could he attach my name to it? Would I be interested? But interestingly, what he put in here was, amongst other things, he says here, there are moments of anti-Semitism which are pretty horrid. And he also said, there are not enough laughs. Now, he knew, he knew I was Jewish, and B, he knew I do a lot of comedy. So I don't think the fact that I'm a Jew, I don't think that's what sold it to him. I think we knew each other's work. Yes. But I think he felt that might help, and that I would come to it with a particular delicacy, shall we say, and care. Anyway, so that was that was 2016 April. The next time I heard from him was July the 25th. And that's when he said, Jeremy Howe, who was commissioning editor of drama until about now, actually, he's just about to go and run The Archers. But Jeremy had been, for about 10 years, he'd been running drama. And he said, oh yes, I love the book. I love the idea of the drama. He'd like me to do it. And his only thing was, it looks horribly expensive. Can you please cut the budget? Can you do something about the budget? So, because he could see it was going to be a big production, it was going to have a fairly large cast. So then another silence. I said, that's fine. And then he came back to me on August the 11th saying, we've agreed a budget. So that was the next move. It then sort of rolled on. There was actually quite a long silence. I've got a vague memory that it may have been frozen for a while because they were still worried about money. And I was working on other projects. And I think around the new year, I thought, I need to get started on this thing. And I was just getting slightly concerned that maybe it had been forgotten or maybe something had happened. So I started working on it, and I wrote, I think, about half, and thought, Mum, do you know, they've sent me a contract. This is very BBC. So I finally got it back, emailed Mark, and subtly or unsubtly mentioned this, and he went, you haven't been paid. So, anyway, it then rolled on, and we record. So I got through a draft of it, sent a draft to Mark, who then looked at it and said, "Oh yeah, oh great, thanks. Can we have a chat?" And I don't know. I'm sure he'd read the book, but he was. I think he'd got slightly confused that he didn't. He seemed to have somehow forgotten that the whole thing happens on a train.
Okay. Yes.
I don't think he'll mind me. I emailed him yesterday. He won't mind me saying this. But he said, "Oh, it's because it just kind of unfolds." And I said, "Well, it does. You know, it does unfold. And I've done what I can to bring in other dynamics." Mm. And he said, "No. I'll look at it. No, you're absolutely right. You're right. It's fine." So anyway, you always. I can't remember now how many drafts. It doesn't say on here how many drafts I did.
Yeah.
But there are always. I mean, I tend to write very assiduous first drafts. Some people do, some people don't. Some people do that'll do. But I don't give people drafts unless I already feel it could be made, you know. And so anyway, that was done. And then we hit the studio, I think, recording Monday the 21st to Wednesday the 23rd of August, 17. Was it 16?
Wow, quite
no, it must have been 17. Yeah, that's right, last year. So that's how close it, that was the run up to it. And then we went into the studio, and then it went out in, you said, didn't you?
Yeah.
November, I think, yes. Last year. So that's sort of how it came about. And it was really because I knew I'd worked with Mark before, and he thought maybe it would be of interest.
That's, wow. So the iterations of the script undergo many, many form, shall we say.
Mm.
And the novel itself is so complex. I mean, every paragraph, a bit like is typical Green, actually. He does compress the writing so much, and so many ideas and voices and sometimes notions of different kinds of themes will find themselves in a single sentence expressed.
Mm.
And one of the questions I would like to ask is, how did you go about managing that? Now, we know that some of the films of Green's novels were not as successful as Green hoped, let alone the people watching them. And the short stories tend to make better films. Now, to compare that to radio and scripting the novel for radio, I wonder how you managed to do it so successfully.
Well, you're absolutely right. And I think on a general point, I remember many, many, many years ago, Jonathan Miller in an interview talking about translating books to the screen. And he said that he felt that either it was quite helpful if the book either wasn't that good,
right,
because you've got, you apart from anything, you feel liberated from, there's a story and there are, or it's a short thing, and then you've got much more room to expand and play with visuals and things. In obviously, in this world, we're playing with audio and music and sound. Yeah. I read the book, go through it, make notes, start working on it. I mean, once I've made notes and I think, well, this would work dramatically, that feels like a tributary that perhaps it's fine to explore on the page, but it's not really going to take the drama anywhere. It's not going to move things on. So those are, you kind of make decisions like that. I tend to make them, some of those decisions early on. Then I start working on it, and it obviously more things I get thrown up. What I tend to find I prefer to do, you have to distance yourself. If you're working on working from a book as opposed to a purely original piece by someone of this standing and stature, and I've done this is the only Green, I think, but I've done quite a lot of War, and I've done some Elizabeth Gaskell and various. Those people, there's a danger that they're sitting on your shoulder, or that they're kind of in the study, leaning over you, and you really don't want that to happen. The best thing to do, I think, is to fall for the subject matter, fall for the characters and the ones that really are going to work for you.
Yeah.
Start working on it, and then, where possible, put the book away.
Okay.
Maybe not even have it on the desk, but if you do, turn it away.
How amazing.
And you work on the script. The further into the script you get, and the more drafts you do, I tend to find the less I look at the book at all, even Green.
Okay.
Because the thing has to stand on its own. You know, there's always that. You're always going to have people who are Green devotees, you know, or any great author. You're not going to damage it. You're not going to kill the book.
Yeah, of course.
If they're very upset by that, read the book and don't listen to the drama or see the drama or whatever it is.
Yeah.
But I don't want to kill the book anyway.
Yeah.
I want to do something new with it, and I want to turn it into something else, a different medium, a different form. And you hope that the best you can do is you stay true to the spirit of it, without sticking with every single word. I've like you, I listen to a lot of drama and Radio 4 and things, and I've occasionally heard dramas where I thought, why is this a drama? It's turned into a reading.
Mm-hmm.
It's, you know, why not just do an abridgment in that case? Just have you know, get Anton Letter to read it.
Yes.
He'll be brilliant, and that's all you need. In other words, there are so, there was one, I can't remember exactly what it was. It was in the past year, I think, and I won't, even if I can, I won't say, because I don't want to. But there were so many narrations. Narrations are a really interesting device to use, but they have to be there for a reason. And I think you've got to be very judicious in the way you use them. So when I do things like the Charles Parris things that Bill Nye plays those characters, none of those, I mean, actually, and Simon, who writes the books, knows this, nothing actually that you hear on air is in the book apart from the plot.
Right, okay.
So there was none of the dialogue, nothing you hear. I mean, in fact, there are new stories on air as well.
Yeah.
But they are one of the kind of, one of the threads that runs through all of those series is Bill doing those narrations, which don't exist in the book.
Right.
So that was a decision I made early on in the first draft. We did a one-off originally, and then before the series, between me and the producer, who's stuck with it all the way through, and that should be, there's be a kind of slightly Chandler-esque, comic Chandler-esque edge to it. But that's just, I'm only mentioning it because that's one of those things. Whenever I do those, I always look at the narrations and be amazed how many of them I go, even sometimes in the studio, we might just go, lose it, cut that one, we don't need it. We're running long, we don't need that one. It's funny, but it's not moving the story, so let's just lose that one. With this, that was one of the early decisions, was what do we do? Narrate or don't narrate? And I kind of felt I didn't really want to have a narrator. I wanted it just to move.
Yes.
And it's on a train, and it's built to have motion.
Yes.
So that was really a gift. And once you've made that decision, then you go, okay, so now we now have to be able to move from character to character, and also from carriage to carriage, and so you know that's
and what does come across quite visibly is the sense of movement. Obviously, it's going from place to place, and each place will have its own culture, its own geography, its own poetics of place. Mm. And it's fair to say as well that different characters emerge in line with the places in which they arrive in different ways. And one of the distinctive features of this particular charm, I think, is the variety of music that seems to characterise the piece. There is such a mellifluous in terms of actors' voices. There is a young girl called Abby Andrews who plays Coral Musker, who really, we were saying before we spoke, in a sense steals the show. You know, she really does come across as playing in the moment in terms of being able to put across Coral Musker's voice in a way that does justice to her attractiveness, I guess. We do have a sense of variety coming across in the very presentation of the voice, but also combined with that is the very traditional way in which the broadcast is presented in terms of, it looks back to quite traditional black and white films in terms of effects, in terms of music, in terms of brass work and so on. To what extent were you happy with the interpretation that the characters gave to your interpretation?
Oh, by and large, I think I was very happy. They were a great cast. Abby, you're quite right. I'll tweet her later. She'll be thrilled to know she's been talked about because I was saying to Martin before, she was a baby, really. She'd come straight out of drama school found herself opposite Joe Milson, who's a very experienced actor. Just as a little background, the BBC drama have a thing called the Carlton Hobbs Award. They do the Norman Beaton Awards, which is a competition for actors who have been acting but have never been to drama school. And then its partner is the Carlton Hobbs, who was a grand old thesp. And his name, his a legacy that was left to the BBC, and that goes to drama schools, and there's a big competition to RADA and Central and all of them to see if young actors about to leave, if they were interested in trying to win this, and they take about half a dozen a year, and the winners, there are lots of runners up, but the winners get a 6-month contract on the BBC rep, which is. So they suddenly find themselves coming straight out of drama school in the summer, and a few months later they're in a studio with anyone, you know, Maggie Smith, Michael Gambon, Joe Milson, whoever, you know, Bill. I mean, that always is a big, you know, you always get a kind of you get a wobbly moment when the new kids come in and Bill sort of says hi to them, you know, this was So anyway, she was brilliant. She really brought a lot to it. But she was very young, and she's probably about 21 or something. And she did bring a great kind of youthfulness and a kind of youthful energy and lightness to it, a lovely lightness of touch. But the music, and sound effects, I mean, if you flick through, I don't know if anyone can see, but if I grab a, that's only a half page, but all those bits in black are either music cues or sound effect cues. And they're things I've written in from the beginning. So I all the way through, I'm seeing it and and hearing it, and so sound effects they can swamp and overwhelm a thing,
right.
But they can also be absolutely what roots it and what just brings it to life, and not just for the listeners, but when you're in the studio, and if you close your eyes from it, and they do a first setup where they play, because sometimes stuff isn't played in because it's too complex. There are lots of technical reasons why it works or doesn't. But in the booth, we very often hear it. And it's absolutely extraordinary how you can be sitting there and you're in the middle of 60A, in the middle of Regent Street, and then suddenly you're in a field or you're on a train and there's a blizzard blowing through the windows. That is absolutely beautiful. They are so good at doing that.
Yes.
I've got such high regard for the studio managers, and because they're all the people who put this together now digitally.
Yeah.
But also a bow to the spot effects SMs, and they're the ones who are standing in there with bags of sugar and whatever you're doing, so it sounds like you're walking on concrete. But music, I love and listen to a lot of. I've always music is important to me, and I tend to put in and use quite a lot of music in various pieces I write.
Right.
So again, I put in a lot of music using it, and I think because Mark also knew that I love music and that I'm good at it, and I know he actually said to me, ooh, I think maybe it may well have been that because I was possibly a bit pushed on the first draft, I might sometimes, if I didn't want to stop the flow, I would just kind of say, music cue here. Yeah. And he then said to me, I remember a bit later on, he said, can you send me a list of things to... because you're good at that. Tell me what you want. So I would then go through, and I thought, now the Honegger is the one I used, and that was because I've got an old Bodley Head edition of with an intro, and which I think Green may have written in the 70s.
71-ish.
Yeah. And in that, he talks about how he went about writing the book. And he was young, and he's one of those, like an actor cliche, he was young and needed the money. But he really, really wanted to sell a book that was going to have a big, broad appeal. Yeah. And he was also very keen that it could be picked up and filmed.
Right.
So he wasn't writing a film treatment, which in fact, I suppose, The Third Man, am I right? That was written as a treatment,
that
really,
was
wasn't
treatment
it?
Place.
Which is... essentially more, it's like a novella. And also The Fallen Idol, was that also written as a treatment?
That was started as a short story.
Right,
Into a film script.
But this obviously was going to be a novel, but he wanted it to be filmed, and he got his way eventually.
Yes.
But he said, you'll probably know, where he went away to a cottage to write this. He left, he'd been somewhere and he...
Yes, at the Spring to Mind. I think it was for sale quite recently, actually. Chipping
there we are. I knew someone here would know that. So he locked himself away there, and he had presumably an old wind-up gramophone, and he heard or bought this, I don't know whether it was just in the place or whether he'd bought this Honegger piece. And for all of my love of music, I thought, I don't know Honegger at all.
Yes.
But with the wonders of the digital age and Spotify, I quickly thought, well, I quickly find out what this is.
Yeah.
Oh, it's an interesting. So I put that on. And so, I can see, it's absolutely right. So we used quite a bit of that. It's used fairly early on.
Right.
Because there's one particular piece called, is it called, another expert here will know, Pacific something, I think.
2-3-1,
that's it.
Thanks.
That's the bit we use. Right. So we use, and that does, it is the sound, it really is, it is the orchestral sound of a train slowly heaving and pulling out of the station. And I said to Mark, we should use some of that, and that will kind of get the whole thing underway. We want to set this train in motion, and nothing is going to stop it. So that's how we did that. I also then put I'm pretty careful about, if I'm going to do something, a period thing like this, I wanted other cues that might also slightly throw the audience, because it's very easy, I think, to do any kind of period costume drama, and you see hats, and you see, you know, and you automatically, it falls into a kind of heritage.
Yes.
It can very easily just fall into a generic sort of, it's a costume drama, it's a period piece.
Yeah.
And I was thinking, well, actually, 1930, I was thinking, well, what was that, what jazz, because I listened to a lot of jazz, what jazz was around? And I would try carefully not to put pieces in that have been released or composed after that date. So I would choose bits of, I can't remember what I put in now, but things that I knew or things that I thought, that's a really great piece, and that would work well against that character. We'll use a bit of that. It's also the right period. So there's actually a lot of thought goes into what music is chosen. It's not just put a bit of music in.
I see. And it's pretty, I would imagine it's generous that you're given such freedom to do so, which leads on to my question, which is maybe a naive question. What role do the director and the producer play in shaping the final broadcast?
It varies.
Right.
In radio, producer and director are the same thing.
Okay.
So that's very different from telly or film, where, telly and film, you'll now have probably one producer and Lord only knows how many executive producers, and everyone's got a hand on, it at various stages, which is another story. But it's partly why things can change radically from the writer originally saying, I want to do, this is my early piece, and things can change. There are too many stories about that, so we won't go there. And too many horror stories about that. But if anyone's ever watched W1A, I don't know if you've ever seen the comedy W1A, that's it. Anyway, but that's universal. It's not, it's closer now to sort of Hollywood stories, right, than, where a writer starts with a project about, or a Graham Greene, and it ends up being about a football team or something. It's just extraordinary the things that get done to things, and you're being pulled in a lot of directions.
Sure.
Radio is that's. Let's touch some wood. So far, it's still, although things are getting harder and budgets are getting tighter, it's a writer's medium, and it's probably closer to theatre. It's closer to theatre and prose, actually.
Yeah.
All of that. It's a very literate and very literary medium, and it's also great for actors. All of that you're very, very hands-on. I'm casting my mind back to think of what it was like when earlier on, but even when I was a really very new, you're still very up close to the whole process.
Right.
So you have a producer who also directs, apart from that, you may occasionally hear a credit where they say such and such was the producer was something and the director. That occasionally happens on certain projects, and that's sometimes if it's an independent. And sometimes there are various reasons why that might happen, but 99% of the time, the producer and director are the same person.
Okay.
And they are very, very hands-on with the writer.
Right, okay.
So whatever way it comes about, whether it's something you've taken to them or they come to you or whatever, you go away and you start working on it, and you get back together and you have script meetings and you go over it, and who knows? Everyone has their own stories.
Yes,
how that can go. That can go well. That can go.
Yeah.
It's a very personal relationship.
Yeah.
You do develop, particularly if you work with people over the years. If you work with these people a lot, you do develop a kind of friendship relationship and a simpatico, so which helps. You don't really want to be working with someone who's pulling in completely the opposite direction.
Right.
That would be bad.
So we're obviously very lucky with this.
Mark was great. We'd only worked together once before. We knew each other to nod to at parties and things, but we'd only worked together once before. But I liked him, and I liked the way he went about things.
Yes.
They're very, very hands-on. Then that's all the pre-production. That's the writing, and then the however many meetings or emails you have saying, can you do this? Can you do that? Can you? Or things can come to you saying, you've got 32 in this cast, and we can afford 10, that kind of thing. In fact, when you your earlier question about how you make decisions, let's not discount the fact that actually sometimes you lose characters or things because you simply, there's no way you're going to be able to afford to do it.
Wow.
So that there's that as well.
Yes.
And that everyone has to do with that, just stripping things out for that reason. You can double.
Right.
So you can, you can say, well, we've got some people from the rep who don't mind playing three or four parts. You won't tend to do that with a star, but You know, so you say, well, actually, but you've got to be very, because your point about the voices being differentiated, yes. You have to be really careful about how that's done.
Exactly.
Because if you have someone of, you know, in their 30s or something, they say, well, actually, I can do 70 when I could also sound like I'm 19. Yeah. That's fine, but you mustn't have them, you've got to separate those scenes. Yeah. So you've got to make sure that person isn't. So the grids that they draw, that the producers draw up with their assistant, by the time you get in the studio, there's a long schedule for the days that you'll be recording.
Yeah.
And they can be so convoluted. It's mind-boggling how. So occasionally you will make things in sequence, scene for scene.
Okay.
Very often you will be making it like a film, so you might start with scene 10, and that can be for other reasons too. That's because, I mean, one of the common reasons is actors being unavailable, so and that gets worse. Not that starry names are necessarily difficult, but they're in demand.
Right.
So if they say, well, we've got you know, like my own sister, but you know,
yes.
say, well, she can do that, but she's doing a film and she can't. Yeah. So she needs to be aware. Or so and so's in the West End. They're in or the National. That's okay, because we can get them across town, or right. they can get themselves, more likely they'll get themselves across town quickly. But they have to finish at 4 to get there, to get into their dressing room, blah, blah, blah. All of that affects what you do. So right. it doesn't necessarily mean you suddenly can't have to lose a character, yeah. but it does mean the schedule has to shift around, because so-and-so has got to be at the National and somebody else has got to be on Shaftesbury Avenue mm-hmm. and somebody else is doing a voiceover or something that they've tried, not a voiceover. But something that is unavoidable.
Yes, yeah.
It's usually something big. So theatre or a film where you can't, radio can't really compete with what they would be paid
right.
in a movie.
Yeah,
you know. So that's how that kind of flexibility has to be built in to their schedule, but also to the way you write it. So there's a series I do called Incredible Women, which I'm in as well with Rebecca. And that has just, I'm just finished a draft of the next series. And it's going to be, I've had to take a very different approach because the budget's been slashed. So it's another 5-part series, but we're not allowed, they've taken a lot of money out of the budget.
Right.
So that has affected, you know, I hope it'll work and it'll be a funny series, but it's going to be a bit different.
Yes.
And the audience, apart from you, the audience won't know. But that's the reason, is they just said that slot has lost a load of money from on high, and I'm afraid, take it all, that's how it's going to be.
Yeah. So I'm guessing you need to make some quite shrewd decisions at every single step
yeah.
of the journey, and the characters, the actors themselves, will need to be quite judicious in what they bring to it. Depending on who's available and who's
not. Well, that's a really good point, because coming back to, you know, the kind of the involvement that the writer yeah. has with the producer and vice versa, what actors bring is invaluable.
Right.
And I remember going to a talk a long time ago to see Arthur Miller talk right. at the National when I was very, very young and very probably starting out and aspiring, and he did a fascinating talk at the National, but he had that amazing way of being, you know, a kind of American intellectual
yeah.
who on the one hand was, you know, had incredible insights, but also was very down to earth and would talk about baseball.
Yeah.
You know. But he talked about actor crap.
Yes. Yeah.
And he said, you have to get used to, if you're gonna be a dramatist, you have to get used to actor crap. And I said, that's very, and I know what he means now.
Yeah.
But I mean, actor crap can actually be, it's not all crap. Partly what happens is you sit for months on end in a room. It's not a job for the faint-hearted.
Right,
it is it's a job for the odd, I think,
yes.
because you spend a lot of time you have to not mind silence and
yes.
being on your own in a room for a very long time. And these characters, you hope, come to life, and the voices become quite real to you.
Yeah.
Then you hand it over, and you go into, and it's cast, and you go, you may have a hand in the casting, but then you go in and you think, wow, well, I didn't hear her sounding at all like that.
That's amazing.
And at that point, you then have a moment where you think, am I happy or am I unhappy? Yeah. Usually you think, actually, that's great. Yes. That's good. Because suddenly it then it's completely reinvented and it's fresh for you. So that's what you do. Obviously, you don't want the reverse. You don't want to go in and think, oh, no. And it does occasionally happen.
Does it really?
Yeah. And also, you occasionally, you have to do enough rehearsing in the studio. And, of course, time is limited.
Yes.
You know, time is money. Yeah. All the time, the clock is ticking. Even if it's an in-house BBC thing, everyone's being paid, and there's a big clock on the wall, and it stares at you, and it's just ticking away from the moment you arrive. So you do as many rehearsals as you can, and sometimes people just get it. They're kind of one-take wonders.
Yeah.
And sometimes you do 2, 3, 4, 5. You never quite know.
Right.
But it's interesting how number of times you might end up with 6 takes, and then they switch the mics off so it's just us talking, and and the producer will look at me and go, okay, we take one, it was the best. So there was something he or she heard that they thought, don't you think? I said, yeah, I think so, yeah. But of course, because of the way everything is now recorded digitally, it's editing. You can actually do instant edits in the studio, which is something they used to do, because I have been doing it long enough to have come in when tape was still happening.
Yeah.
And tape, the technique of cutting tape still blows my mind. It was absolutely remarkable. And you could say to a brilliant studio manager 25 years ago, actually, could we just hear that back?
Yeah.
And they would then have tape around their neck, whip things out. And it was, you've heard the probably references to razor blades. They literally used razor blades, cut tape on a thing, stuck it together, and said, how about that?
Stunning.
And, or could you take that pause out?
Yeah.
It's gone.
Yeah.
And you hear it, and you go, yeah, that works. Now it's all done on a screen.
Right.
And you're watching little peaks and troughs. Every breath is a peak and a trough. And they do that digitally. So they'll sit there with a keyboard now and go, can you go back? And they just go back and they isolate a little area.
Yeah.
They can isolate that.
Gosh.
And it's gone. Just to play it back.
Yeah.
So you can say, did someone's stomach rumble? Because that was a brilliant take. We really loved it. But I've got a feeling her stomach rumbled.
Oh, gosh.
So you can go back, have a listen. Because, of course, you've got huge speakers in there. And also little speakers, because they always consider people listening on a small radio, which is, you know, again, I don't know if people realize that it's not, yes, we listen on enormous things, which, you know, fabulous sound, but they always have little speakers so that you can play it back, just so you know that if someone is ironing or whatever or in their car, you've got an idea that they're listening to it, they're not listening to it on a massive speaker like that. And that you can just, with a bit of luck, if there's no overlap, you can take out that stomach rumble and go, yeah, that is the tape, we'll keep it.
So. Nicely. Brilliant.
But they do, but, you know, going back to your, the actors bring so much.
Yes.
And that's where, again, it's music, because in a sense, I've composed a score, and then they come in like a little a chamber or an orchestra, and they bring the whole thing to life, and it's a great thing when it works.
Yes.
It's a marvelous feeling.
Like magic, I guess. As I listened again and again, sometimes intently, sometimes in the background to Stumble Train, there were certain moments that stood out every time. I don't know how conscious you or Mark Beebe may have been of them. So, for example, there are certain humorous moments. Mabel Warren is confronted at a station, and she's called Mein Herr. Mm. Obviously, my sir, perhaps she's been mistaken for a man. And there are moments at the very beginning. Carl Musker is asked whether she might get together with someone on the course of her journey.
Mm.
And she says, one can't tell, can one?
Mm.
And these moments are telling of how the characters develop, insofar as Mabel Warren does take on what would traditionally be seen as a masculine role, because she rescues Coral after the kangaroo court has blown up and Dr. Jinnah escapes and unfortunately is shot, but Coral does escape. And there were a number of other moments of such kind where the drama and the combination of silences and music were punctuated quite nicely and almost served to cut up the production into nicely digestible units. Were you aware of inserting those hooks, or was that something that came from the actors?
Possibly a bit of both.
Right.
I mean, you do seed things. Mm. And sometimes it's referred to as reverse engineering.
Yes.
Sometimes you get further down the line with a piece and you think, actually, that's sort of paying off there, but I think it needs to be, we need that, it's kind of, you've done the reiteration.
Yeah.
We need to slightly heighten it earlier on, just so that comes back.
Mm.
And also little moments like that can sometimes come where you think, and I've had producers say to me, you know, that pays that bit off.
Yes.
That's what you were doing. It's too far away. That was back at the beginning. We need. Can you put in another reference?
Yes.
So seed another reference to whatever it was further down the line, just so that the audience just to help them along, and just
yes.
so they're not going, what? I missed that completely. You don't want them to have to go back and
yeah.
listen to it. How many
yeah.
times did you? Say? So I think things like that. I think. Yeah, I mean, silences, the
yeah.
pauses, yeah, absolutely crucial. I mean, it's one of the things that writers need to be able to stop and allow breathing space.
Yeah.
And actors always learn, I think, the instinct is just keep talking,
Yeah.
But actually, probably one of the most frightening things for any actor, whether it's in a radio studio or on stage, is to stop and just leave that silence hanging. And in radio, they call it dead air.
Right.
And what I did then would have been a terrible bit of dead air
right.
on radio, but
yeah.
that's why you
yeah.
do it. It's there to, and it, it's light and shade, and
yeah.
it's there to contrast the next
sure,
thing.
Sure.
I mean, we use, but in terms of the structuring
yeah.
it into kind of.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, it is literally just structuring the whole piece. I was rereading the book prior to working on it because I'd read it probably when I was in my 20s,
right.
so a lot.
Right.
I was very relieved, actually, because Mark and I were both a bit worried about the train. Not so much because of its... I like the idea of it being enclosed. I thought
yeah.
the claustrophobia could be conveyed really well, and you've trapped people on a train, and that's great. So it wasn't so much that, but it was I was very relieved that there were moments where we stop and people get off and people get on. It helped to just structure. It was partly, I think, we had said, oh God, is there going to be a train? Are we going to hear a train under the whole thing?
Right.
Is it just going to be the same sound of rolling stock?
Yeah.
It's kind of cha-chung, cha-chung, because that could get quite wearing.
Yeah.
And obviously we did use a lot, but we tried to align those with music and also change them.
Right.
And so there were a lot of sliding doors.
Yes.
Now, again, I'm old enough to remember the old
yeah.
British Rail sliding doors, which I loved. And I thought, actually, they're great. I love those sliding. Why don't we have lots of sliding doors?
Yes.
But it helps kind of break the rhythm.
Yeah.
And also, I was saying to Martin before, there is an old image, I think, of people working in radio that they're sort of doing that. They're either sitting or standing around a mic. And that's not it. Everything is stereo now. Occasionally, it's binaural, which is a very big deal.
Right.
But studios are enormous. I mean, they are like film sets. And there are rooms, there are staircases, there are rooms upstairs. Depends on what studio
yeah.
you're working in. But we made this in 60A, which is the big broadcasting house drama studio.
Yeah.
Maida Vale is another
right.
Big drama studio.
Okay.
And they've got kitchens, and they've got bedrooms, and they've got curtains, and they've got windows, and they've got sliding windows, and they've got casements and catchments, you name it. They've got all sorts of different. And people are moving all the time. They're running through sets. They're moving. They're walking through. They're walking from one interior to another or
yeah.
to an exterior. And so that was really doing this because, of course, we had this very enclosed thing. So everything is enclosed.
Yeah.
How do we make things more? So when Mabel goes to the locks herself in a loo,
yes.
you had to make an enclosed space, a more enclosed space than the rest. So she has to go into another room.
Right.
In a big drama studio, they have areas called, they have a dead room.
Yeah.
And I think 68 has an interesting one, which is actually, it's built like the inside of a snail shell. So you can stand on the outside, and then the person, there could be another mic right the way, it's almost like a little maze on the inside. And the further in they go, the deader and the more enclosed the sound, until there's almost a completely, there's nothing around them at all. It's a kind of void. But you use all of this.
Yeah.
And so we used a lot, you know, a lot of that in this to create, so if you're in a corridor, what was the corridor we were going, and you get the studio managers to go out there and physically build the corridor space.
Yeah.
So that's where, right, Joe, you're there, Abby, you're here, Sinner, you're coming, you're opening that door, coming in through here. He may not physically be opening it, somebody will do it for him, but he crosses over from one space, which is mic'd with a different sort of mic,
right,
and a different sort of acoustic,
right,
and that's all being also being manipulated and fed from where we are in the box. And then you go into the next space and all those mics turn over onto so it's a very kind of physically acted thing. People are on their feet.
Yeah.
And they're walking and I know from personal experience quite often running as well.
Is that right? Yeah. Quite some stamina.
Yeah.
Well, I've got lots more questions, but I'm conscious some of you may have questions you are itching to ask. Jeremy, do we have a mic?
You will need a moment.
Okay. So, firstly, at the front, Martin Jenkins would like to ask a question.
Good afternoon, sir.
Hello.
You're in the program as Jeremy Hunt. I was expecting to see the Foreign Secretary.
I know. I'm sorry to disappoint.
The cottage, £1 a week with rats, and he was with his wife who was expecting their first child. Had a moderate success, two abysmal failures. This book had to succeed.
It had to win, didn't it? Yeah.
And I think the film rights were sold before the book was published, I believe. Mm. But I wonder if the way the book was written in terms of the film script, I wonder if that is helpful for drama on the radio, or I don't know.
It didn't. I mean, when I refer to, you know, The Third Man being a treatment, that, you know, a treatment, if anyone's ever, if you ever write or see a treatment, that really is, that can, well, it can be, actually, it can be a many, many different things, but that's a kind of, it could just be a beat document in which they say, you know, it starts here, da da da, this happens, that happens, that happens, that's the end. You're not going to get Graham Greene writing a beat document like that. And this, certainly, this reads as a, I was talking to my wife about it this morning before I left, because we were saying that a book, he wanted this to be a big seller and a big hit. And we were comparing it to something like Murder on the Orient Express. And we were thinking, it's all comparative, isn't it? It's all, because Green's idea of a very popular seller, and I think it did do quite well. Did it do well?
It was a Book Society Choice.
Yeah. So that would have been. We were what we don't know. I mean, maybe somebody else knows. We were wondering how he felt about Murder on the Orient Express, because presumably Orient Express has presumably sold billions over the years. Now that, in commercial terms, is a huge success. Not quite the same kind of book. Mm. And I think, you know, that it's just very interesting. I think that, you know, when you've got a great writer, and even when they say, "I'm really going for it this time. I'm going for a seller." It's got big themes. It's got big, deep themes in it, which is not the standard fare of, you know, a big blockbuster bestseller. I've never seen the 30 whatever it was film, which I didn't really want to see it before. I'd like to see it now.
Yeah.
I'd really like to see what it's like. But have you seen it?
No, I haven't. No.
I'm intrigued to know what it's like, but.
Heinemann writer, long-time writer, he threatened to sue Green and publishing.
Over that.
Q.C. Savory, the novelist, the novel, had written a book called The Great A. Brown.
Yes.
It had sold tons of them. And Priestley thought, of course, this is the good companion.
Yeah.
So we're not having that.
Yeah.
I suppose that was the idea.
Yeah, in that intro I've got to the old Bodley Head one, he refers to that, and I think Green says I was threatened with a lawsuit. He said, I think he said it's nonsense. It wasn't based on Priestley at all, but suspect it probably was.
Quite cutely, yeah.
There's, you know, I think it was good. It was good old fashioned A, British snobbery, and B, writer bittery. And you know, it happened.
I think I remember you telling me Martin Green was forced to make the changes in a phone box at the last minute.
On the village
green. Yes.
Martin. Yeah. It's working. First of all, thanks very much for the drama. I thought it was superb. It came across really well on the radio.
Thank you.
I was interested really early on when you mentioned Mark Bibby mentioning anti-Semitism.
Yeah.
When I heard the broadcast, I'm pretty sure that the continuity announcer that fed into it said, and now there's, you know, dramatisation of Ben Green's Seattle Train. Listeners may find it reflects a lot of the social and racial prejudices, did you say, or attitude of the time.
Yeah, I think you're right.
There's a kind of then an unspoken, so if you don't like it, don't write into us. It's
yeah.
Any comments on that, the social and racial attitudes of the time in the novel?
I do, and we, I was saying to Martin, we did run into a little, wasn't it? A little problem. They did have, because I've got a whole, I traced back to my emails, and that is a paper chase of emails that came after, how many pages are there? Quite a few. After it went out, because Jeremy Howe, who was, as I say, he was just the outgoing commissioner of drama, he was approached by Feedback, which is the Radio 4 complaint thing. As far as we know, it was only one person, I think, which is, you know, I think it was quite a few people heard it. I think, you know, I was thinking that was a bit of an overreaction for one. And I don't think they accused anyone of anti-Semitism, and they would have come up against an interesting one with me. But they did say, in fact, I've got, I think the original thing, Jeremy wrote and emailed Mark and said, I've been asked to go on Feedback, and have you got any thoughts on this? How did you approach it? And I think I've got the original email that Feedback sent him, and he'd done some one-line answers, slightly, you know, fairly quick and curt. And then Mark, and I think Mark then got back to him slightly horrified. He said, oh God, no. And I'm going to get, should we get Jeremy involved too? And so then I wrote quite a lot to Jeremy saying, well, look, Here's my approach to it, and here's what I think. And we had, Jeremy Howe and I had quite a few exchanges prior to him going on. Then the last one said, don't worry, I've recorded it now, it was all fine. But he said, interestingly, I think what happened was when he went on to Feedback, he said he was slightly frustrated because he was armed with his opinions and mine about what we, you know, whether what we should left in, what we shouldn't have left in. And he said, actually, it really turned into a broader discussion about should the BBC be doing anything that has sort of, that all reflects opinions that are no longer, you know. And, well, that's the point. I mean, I had to say, you know, A, as a Jewish writer, I was very, very well aware of it. And I was asking myself, I remember it, even from reading it in my 20s, that had jumped out at me. I thought, wow, what am I, now am I reading, is this the character or is this the author? Mm. And sometimes you can give the benefit of the doubt, and sometimes you think, well, maybe. You then start to reflect, you do have to look at the context in which it was written. And actually, one of the things I said to Jeremy is, well, where do we draw the line? Do we now say we don't do Virginia Woolf, who was married to a Jew and said some of the most scabrous things about Jews? Then again, she was also a deeply disturbed woman. Do we do The Merchant of Venice? Do we do Marlowe? Do we do War? Do we do, I mean, it goes, really, the list goes on and on and on and on. I mean, Mariah Edgeworth, you know, you can go, Jeremy got back to me and said, oh, I think we definitely carry on doing The Merchant of Venice. He said, I've got it here, I think. He said, I'm still uncomfortable with Marlowe. And Jeremy's not Jewish at all, but he said, I think he's having fun with the audience at the expense of a minority. And he said, I think it bothers me. Duke of Malta. He said he bothers me a lot more. But anyway, I think you, the way my broad approach, if I thought it was an overtly anti-Semitic book or an inflammatory book, I would have thought twice and possibly said, no, probably said no. I'm not. I don't want to do it. Give it to somebody else. Or you have to consider the audience. I think you know it's an intelligent audience. Radio 4 is a not you know its audience are literate and they're intelligent and they're adults, and they need to know that you know they do know that stuff is going to occasionally come their way that it's not always supposed to make them feel comfortable. What I didn't want to do was to appear to side with those. So if I did anything, apart from maybe losing some references, if I did anything, it might have been to shine a slightly different light on it so that the characters who did say things we didn't really like. But I think actually, I don't think you do really like, but it is very, very difficult. You know, I mean, Dickens, what do you, you know, do you, his depiction of Fagin, what do? You know, it's not comfortable. And I suppose this became, it was bad enough a year ago when I did it, but I'm kind of slightly relieved it wasn't going out this year because it would have been a very hot potato, and I wonder whether we would have had one person writing into to feedback or whether it would have been a lot, and possibly a lot. Maybe I'd have been one of them, I don't know. But it is, you know, and I've read all sorts of different accounts of Green. And I still don't quite know where I stand, but I felt it. I didn't feel it was making me that uncomfortable. I thought we could deal with it, but it was clearly on Mark's because this. He said here this is here early when he got in touch with me in April 16. He said you may of course not fancy it. There are moments of anti-Semitism which are pretty horrid. But we would lose those, I hope. Well, we didn't lose all of them because I took the decision that it felt wrong to lose them because also Myatt, whether you like Green's depiction of him or not, Myatt is a Jew, and if you take all of those out, it's suddenly the whole thing just starts to it's a souffle that just deflates. I mean, what do you do? Thing is how you handle it thereafter, but
there is obviously a very rich body of criticism on how Green handled some of the anti-Semitism that he represented sometimes. And Cedric Watts is the go-to person on that. We've heard him talk many times about that. I think we will need to draw things to a close. I would like to ask one final question. I'm conscious there will be some creatives in the audience who may be aspiring writers. And I am, because part of the work of the Trust is to really educate some people sometimes about specific interests. Some people come for specific reasons to talks. Do you have any advice for budding writers of radio drama in terms of how they might develop work or start somewhere or how to go about becoming a professional?
The odd thing about, I've said this in recent years when I've done a few things like this or I've been interviewed for things, the really strange thing is that your entire life suddenly, it telescopes. And you find yourself sitting on a platform talking to a group of delightful people and talking about what you do. And there's a little, another little voice going, oh, is that how it happened? Is that what you did? Okay. Or as I think I once saw Tom Stoppard being interviewed, and he was given a build-up, and he said, God, it must be great to be me. that's the reaction I had at the time when I was much younger, and I know exactly, because you think, oh, it's all so neat and tidy, isn't it? Yes, of course I did that. No, and it's, of course, actually, it's messy and it's chaotic like the rest of life. And But people, I think, in terms of trying to do stuff in broadcasting, write, keep writing, keep rewriting.
Yeah.
I think there is an old adage that writing, I think it may be Neil Simon who coined this, that writing is actually rewriting. And you can see this, if you go to the British Library and look at a Dickens manuscript or Jane Austen, you know, very rarely is it one neat page of beautifully calligraphed writing. There are scribbles everywhere, and it's a matter of refinement. But I suppose getting involved now, well, I suppose it's probably similar to when I started, but you need to get the ear of a producer or a script editor, and you need to get stuff in front of them, which is, in some ways, with the BBC, it's not that difficult because they're in the Radio Times.
Yeah.
They're on all the credits. So if you, I mean, it's like the thing when I was younger with agents. When I used to, every play script I ever opened, it would say for a long time I'd open a Methuen or a Faber script, and it would very very often say represented by Margaret Ramsay. And I said, I wonder who this Margaret Ramsay is. And as it happens, she was the very first agent who asked to meet me. And she was this doyen. She was, I met her when she was probably in her 80s by then. And she'd read something of mine and said, oh, it was, come in and have tea. And I was young and green and terrified. But it's one of those things where the only reason I knew anything about Margaret Ramsay is because I'd read all the plays, and in the front it always said permissions were granted by Margaret Ramsay Associates, or Peggy as she was known, and I'd seen the room that Joe Alton, who was one of her boys, she always had boys, there were photographs, if you ever look at the Joe Alton diaries, the photographs of her office with all these all the little bits of artwork and these collages he and Halliwell made, and I suddenly found myself sitting in that office thinking, oh, this is terrible. And she had things like that all the way lining the walls and alphabetically, and in a big black marker pen it just said went Arden, Bond, Bennett, Beckett, and it just went on and on and on. And she walked, and she eventually swanned in, sorry, this is slightly off the track, but she swanned into the room, I remember, and said, sorry, because people, you always learn things. She said, I'm so sorry, I've just been on to Christopher Hampton. Do you know Christopher Hampton? And I was about 23 or something. And she said, oh, he's just made $1 million. From the film rights of Les Liaisons. He was saying, what do I do? I don't know what to do with the money. He said, bricks and mortar, darling, bricks and mortar. I think I borrowed the money to get from my mum to get to the meeting, you know.
Yeah.
But agent, that's another thing. But I think BBC are quite good at actually, if you're talking, there are theatres as well, they have literary managers. BBC don't tend to do that. They do now have a thing called the Writers' Room, which I think new people go to. I'm not sure if that's just for comedy or drama as well, but quite a lot of people, I think, send things into the Writers' Room and they kind of exchange. And there's no career ladder. You sort of, by hook or by crook, you find your way, and with a bit of luck, you meet some people and someone will go, oh, we'll give it a go.
Brilliant. It does sound like the process of getting there and then actually producing the piece is characterised by some happen chance at every stage. And
it really, yeah.
It's, well, really it's is. Been an absolute joy to learn about how this took form on the radio. And I do urge you to listen to Jeremy as his series are released. Obviously, there, as I mentioned, there is the Charles Paris Mystery Series. There is a wonderful edition of Chain Reaction in which he interviews his sister Rebecca, who's the BAFTA-winning actress. And obviously Millie and Jack is a must-listen too. So ladies and gentlemen, can I ask you to put your hands together for Jeremy Front? Thank you, Jeremy.
Thank you very much, thank you. Thanks very much. Thanks for asking me.
Thank you.
That's good. Enjoyable.